We're going to go on to case 034050, Ramos Ramos versus Ashcroft. Mr. Kelleher.
May it please the court, Christopher Kelleher on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. Miguel Ramos. Your Honors, the two issues in this case are whether Mr. Ramos's due process and equal protection rights were violated in his removal proceeding. As to the due process claim, the Constitution, as construed by this court, mandates that a removal proceeding be fundamentally fair.
Let me ask you what I think this case may turn on. Obviously, there are jurisdictional issues having to do with the substantiality of his claims, but in the criminal law area, which of course this is not, there are a few bare minimum rights that have to be exercised by the defendant himself. You know, the lawyer can't stand up and say, I'm entering a guilty plea on behalf of the defendant. The judge has to say, how do you plead? I understand your argument to be that there is some analogous bare minimum in the immigration context, that it's not good enough to show the form selecting a lawyer to represent oneself. And, of course, here we don't have Mr. Ramos ever actually showing up at any of these hearings. I'm not aware of any authority that supports that. Are you?
Well, Your Honor, the EOI R28 form does not explain the rights or the procedures.
Well, that's why I'm trying to get behind it, because certainly the signing of that form is enough to entitle the lawyer to do a lot of things on Mr. Ramos's behalf, and I don't take it that you are saying it was a forged signature or that somehow or another he didn't know that this lawyer was there. Obviously, that would be a rather different case. So the question is one of whether in the immigration context, the lawyer was behaving in an appropriate way, and one can even delegate this much to the lawyer, or whether the immigration context has a rule analogous to the criminal rule. And I'm just not aware of any authority on that point. I wondered if you were.
Your Honor, there's no specific authority that points to what you're referring to. However, the statute 8 U.S.C. 1229 and the regulations clearly provide that an alien should be able to be placed, should be placed under oath, should have his identity established.
Right. Let me ask you this. You claim that he was prejudiced because he didn't have an opportunity to challenge his conviction document or raise ineffective assistance by his criminal attorney or designate a country and so forth. Setting aside for one moment that his attorney could have raised any of these things, would the outcome have been any different if he had an opportunity to object to these things? In other words, does he seriously contest the fact of his conviction? Does he seriously contest that Mexico would be the appropriate place for him to have been returned?
No, Your Honor. He does not contest that Mexico is not the place. However, the conviction itself, as I stand here, I would concede for immigration purposes, it is final. However, we do not...
So you're conceding that Gill against Ashcroft does apply to this and that he has this conviction notwithstanding the state law procedure for expunging it?
Yes, in light of Gill, the argument, we do not have an argument. However, we do argue that Mr. Ramos, or I should say that the government, did not properly prove Mr. Ramos's removal. The conviction record itself, we do not believe, was properly presented. It was never formally admitted, it was never authenticated, and it had three different dates.
But you know, I mean, it sounds to me like what you're really doing is you're making, again, to take the criminal analogy, you're making a structural error point. You're saying no matter whether there's prejudice or no prejudice, you know, once again, there is a very small list of things that are recognized as structural in the criminal law area, if you have no lawyer, you know, and your Sixth Amendment right was violated, it doesn't really matter whether there was overwhelming evidence. You are entitled to a lawyer, period. See Gideon. So you have to be saying that this is just one of these things that's so fundamental that notwithstanding your inability to prove prejudice, notwithstanding the fact that the lawyer is designated, he still is entitled to a different proceeding, which, from all I can tell, is going to lead to the identical result.
And it may. Your Honors, our underlying premise is straightforward, and that is the numerous failures to follow immigration provisions, coupled with the IJ's reliance on unfounded admissions and a questionable conviction record, dictate that such a hearing is not fundamentally fair and that Mr. Ramos suffered prejudice.
Wasn't your client removable on grounds separate and apart from the conviction? And so the focus on the whole issue about the conviction and any equal protection challenge on that ground really would be pointless because he was removable on grounds separate and apart from that second ground for removal.
Well, Judge Sykes, the IJ based his decision on that ground on admissions that Mr. Ramos never made. As we point out, the IJ relies on admissions, the factual allegations 1 through 5.
Admissions made by his attorney on his behalf after having waived his appearance.
Well, his attorney never made those admissions either. Those factual allegations are never admitted in the record by Mr. Ramos, obviously, or his counsel. So on that ground, we would argue then that ground also arise
of
questions.
Wait a minute. Bear with me for one moment. At one point during the April 28th hearing, the IJ says, I mean, essentially the issues don't appear to be in dispute. There's no dispute that the respondent was convicted. The conviction record entered into evidence as Exhibit 2, if I'm reading it correctly, indicates that there was a plea of no conscience. That was accepted in a finding of guilt then entered by the court. Is that correct? Would the parties agree with that? And Mr. Chavez replies, Judge, I think the record is pretty clear. Yes, there's no dispute. That really seems like an admission by counsel of all the relevant facts, including the conviction record. Am I missing something?
No, as to the conviction record, I would admit that. However, the factual allegations, the conviction record, again, is I noted earlier, there's questions that we raise about the conviction record itself. But the factual allegations, which I believe, from all I can tell, are contained in the notice to appear, there's no evidence in the record that anyone admitted to those. They're not even raised.
You're not saying that he otherwise, though, had some right, getting back to Judge Sykes' point, that he, let's say that the I-130 process was finished and he already had the right to be in the United States. He was undocumented as of the time these things happened, right?
Not as far as I understand. He had one I-130 petition.
It was just a petition, though. I mean, the process hadn't finished, right?
Yes, and he was also, when he was arrested, he was there for a I-45 adjustment meeting. He was married to a U.S. citizen.
Right, but he had not, I guess what I'm trying to get at is he had not overcome yet the fact that he didn't have a right. He wasn't a lawful permanent resident alien. He wasn't a naturalized citizen. He wasn't, you know, in the asylum process. There are various ways that people who are here have the right to be in the United States, but he hadn't finished qualifying for any of them, had he?
No, he was still in the process, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
I see I'm in my rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Keller. Mr. Andre. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, and John Andre for the respondent. On the due process point, I would just add to that, to what the comments of the panel, that there's nothing unusual at all about an attorney waiving the appearance of the alien at an immigration court hearing.
You're going to have to speak up, please. So are you saying that it's common in the immigration context for proceedings to happen entirely without the physical presence of the immigrant?
It is actually common in a situation like this where the issue before the immigration court is purely legal issue.
And so how do you know that you even have the right person or that you've got a validly executed council form, I forget the number, but
28.
That form. Couldn't it all just be terribly mistaken? I mean, there are, you know, lots of Ramoses from Mexico. We see quite a few of them even here. Plenty of Garcias and Garzas and everything else. How do you know you've got the right guy?
There is always the possibility of a mistake on the form, but in this instance, we have the signature of Mr. Ramos on the form that was submitted to the court. And in addition to that, we have the appearance of Mr. Chavez on behalf of Mr. Ramos. And Mr. Chavez and Mr. Ramos have been in contact with each other. So the likelihood of a mistake happening and Mr. Chavez representing the wrong Mr. Ramos is a very slight one. And another point to add to that is that Mr. Ramos was detained by the INS at this time.
Where in the record did Mr. Ramos or his attorney make the admissions on which the IJ relied? In other words, the record sites that you gave show that the IJ started treating these things as admitted, but I need to know where in the record they actually admitted them.
There is, on page 143 of the record, that is the third, that is the charging document, that is the notice to appear. If you look at the first half of the page, there are charges 1 through 5.
Uh-huh. Well, this is this big A that we're supposed to assume means admitted?
Well, that's the indication in the record that it was admitted, and Mr. Chavez did not make any objection to that being the evidence of the admission.
And was the Nebraska conviction entered as evidence somewhere there, too? I mean, I know it was marked as an exhibit, but where was it accepted as evidence?
Mr. Chavez actually conceded to the conviction. He did not contest the conviction. So that's in the transcript, and I can...
But it wasn't entered as evidence itself?
It was, according to the transcript, it was actually accepted into evidence. The document itself was accepted into evidence. And the document, the conviction document is also
in there somewhere.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you know, he disputes your statement that he was wrongfully present in the U.S. because the INS approved his petition to be with his wife.
There was no approval of any petition.
His sponsor, yeah.
There's no record of any approval of any petition in this case. Only if the petition had been approved, if the adjustment application had been approved, then he would have been legally in the United States. Also,
so what was the status of the I-130?
The I-130 was denied, but by the time...
No, but at the time he was... because Mr. Chavez, at one point in the record, says, unfortunately, the respondent does have an approved I-130, and I believe he has a pending adjustment application.
All right. I may have misspoken. His I-130 was approved, but his adjustment application was denied.
And are people who are in the I-130 process provisionally entitled to be... I mean, of course, they knew he was in the country, because he was married to the U.S. citizen, he'd given his correct address.
There is no right to actually reside in the United States there, in the sense of a parole or some sort of an official status in the United States. They don't have any status to remain in the United States. What they can apply for is work authorization, and there's I don't know whether or not he applied. I don't know whether or not he was given work authorization. I don't see anything in the record to indicate whether he was given work authorization. But the bottom line of all this, I think, is that even if he had permission, let's assume for the sake of argument that he had permission to be in the United States while his petition was pending or while his adjustment application was pending, all that was denied. And when... if we're looking at the prejudice issue, there's no prejudice because he doesn't now have permission. Even if he got a new hearing, and even if he prevailed on his drug, on the drug charge, in having the immigration court dismiss that charge, he still would not have any right for permission to reside in the United States because his adjustment application based on the marriage has been denied.
So he's just flat out wrong when he argues that because the INS approved his decision, or rather his petition, to be with his family and his wife as sponsor. He's just flat out wrong.
Well, I'm not sure as far as the petition being approved. That is not, it's a two-step process, and this is often confusing. The petition being approved is only a procedural, it's a formal decision. It doesn't mean that he has the right to be here. He can then apply for adjustment of status, and if he is granted that, then he can stay. Then he has status. He's a lawful permanent resident.
How confused. That
sounds like a procedure created by Franz Kafka.
Yes, to be told your petition is approved, you can be with your wife and family in Mexico.
Well, it is confusing, and it probably could be done better, but that's just the way
and
the
I
process
I assume the Mexicans could deport the wife and child also, because, of course, they're not Mexican citizens.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch all of that.
I said I assume it would be entirely within the discretion of the country of Mexico to deport his wife and child back to the United States because they're not Mexican citizens and they have no right to live in Mexico by parity of reasoning to what the United States does.
I'm not.
Now, we're assuming the Mexicans wouldn't do that, but that's a rather cocky assumption, it seems to me.
It sure is these days.
I don't have any expertise in the Mexican system, but I assume that there would some, since he is a Mexican citizen, he would have some ability to.
Well, she's a U.S. citizen. She doesn't have any ability to keep her husband with her, so why should a Mexican citizen have the ability to keep his wife with him?
Well, I suppose that I should amend my comments slightly, and to say that if he were to come back, if he were to prevail on his drug offense, and if it were not, if he were to convince the court that the conviction should be expunged and is no longer a conviction, and his only basis for not having permission to be in the United States is that he was illegal, then he could petition. He could perhaps petition again and ask the board to consider the adjustment application in light of the court's determination that he doesn't have a conviction, and then he could, but at this point, where we stand right now.
So the conviction actually is quite important to him.
Yeah.
This issue, it sounds like from what you're saying,
yes,
is central. Okay.
Let me just ask you real quickly, do you consider the status of the FFOA to be an open question in the circuit following ARERA?
No, the issue has been disposed of by the court in Gill.
Okay.
The court has expressly disagreed with the Ninth Circuit in Lujan. The reason I gave a lot of time in my brief is simply that the court did not actually come out in Gill and address the equal protection issue, but it implicitly rejected the equal protection claim, which was really the underlying basis for the decision in Lujan.
Okay.
So I don't really see it as being an open question in the circuit.
Thank you very much.
You.
Mr. Kelleher.
Judge Rovner, Gill, while it did say state expungements were final, it did not say that the FFOA was repealed by implication. And it also did not address, nor did the parties raise, the equal protection issue. So that issue has not been resolved by Gill. While Gill frowned upon Lujan, obviously, it did not answer the issues that we are raising here. To the due process issue, Your Honors, the I-130 and the I-485, those two petitions were eventually denied because of the drug conviction. And what I think here respondent is asking us to assume a lot of things from this record and a lot of things from this case. And I would respectfully assert that removal is far too serious a business to be dealing in assumptions. Now, if there are no further questions, I would ask that the removal hearing be reopened.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kelleher, and thank you very much, Mr. Andre. The case will be taken under advisement.